Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Thursday, April 2nd, 2015. I almost said 2005. So we've got a couple public hearings and a work session today. Since we have Representative Davis here, I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2241. While Representative Davis is getting settled, Beth, would you mind giving us a summary of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2241 would direct the Department of Environmental Quality to study and propose recommendations on legislative, regulatory, and other actions necessary to develop a program to allow an opportunity for participants to conduct voluntary removal or remedial actions at a facility under a single coordinated process. That would be a facility addressing hazardous waste remediation. There's no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. Statement's not yet prepared.
Excellent. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. It is my pleasure to bring to you probably the most important piece of legislation in this entire building this year. It is a study bill. We all know how important those are. So I hope I piqued your interest today. You all know, and I know have received both informational hearings and heard previously bills addressing brownfield sites in the state of Oregon. And we have a wonderful brownfields remediation coalition that has brought, I believe, at least three or maybe up to five legislative concepts to the legislature. I believe all of those require a significant investment on the state side, either in the form of a tax credit or a direct budgetary ask. For example, for the land bank, well, I think the land banking program as a policy item, but the others do require recapitalization of the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund or the tax credit or even the land recycling or land banking bill would require local governments to expend significant amounts of public monies. So when I started thinking about brownfields rather late in the game, because I have not been involved with the Brownfields Coalition until earlier this year, the idea for a program similar to Pennsylvania's land recycling program, also known as the Act II program, came to my attention and I came up with this idea to perhaps bring some of its elements into Oregon. Now, the broad strokes of Pennsylvania's program is it's widely known the significant environmental damage and contamination in that state, in large part due to the steel industry and the history there. They were left with hundreds, I think thousands of sites throughout the state that were abandoned after that industry went under, and were at the forefront in the 90s and 2000s in developing a policy package with the federal government and at the state level for allowing redevelopment of those sites. And that did include subsidies. It did include many of the other elements that we're considering in the legislature. But part of it was adoption of the Act II program. What that did in broad strokes is through an agreement with the federal EPA that if a potential purchaser of a brownfield site entered into a very detailed remediation plan with Pennsylvania's state Department of Environmental Quality, then that party, to the extent that they went through that very detailed remediation plan, would have both a release from state-level environmental liability for previous contamination and the equivalent of a no-action letter from the federal EPA under CERCLA, the federal environmental law, that both the state and the feds would likely not enforce federal and state liability against a purchaser who redevelops and a remediation plan. It was a very detailed program they entered into. I know we have elements of it in Oregon already in statute. You're going to hear later from DEQ talking a little bit about that. I also know that later in the 2000s, the federal government, Congress, did strengthen CERCLA, the federal law, to allow more states to take advantage of this sort of program that Pennsylvania was the forerunner for. But I think the attractiveness is that if we can get our state statutes and our state programs really at the spear's edge, the spear's tip of what we can do at a state level on a policy side that doesn't require direct budgetary subsidies, it doesn't require tax credits, but allows us to work on a policy level to say if a developer or a purchaser, a prospective purchaser, comes to a property, is willing to enter into a legally binding and very detailed detailed remediation plan, that that party should not be liable for someone else's negligence, someone else's misdeeds that happened in the past. That we should reward them, in a sense, for coming to the property and remediating that property and not have the hammer held above them that CERCLA, frankly, does for purchasers of potential liability because of being an owner or operator of the site. As we know, it's a strict liability statute, and you could have liability for something that was done 100 years ago simply because you owned it. So the intent of this bill is to move that process along, as why it starts as a study bill, to ask DEQ to do the work with our federal partners to say, what can we do? Is there anything we need to do to make sure our statutes and our programs are at the bleeding edge so that we can do the most possible without subsidy to redevelop these sites? So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer questions about the bill, and I know that DEQ will have a few words to say about what they're already doing, and much of what they're doing is very positive. So I want to thank them for both meeting with me about this bill, for being open, and for, frankly, already being very far along in this process.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Questions? No? Okay.
Thank you
so much. All right, and we are going to have DEQ give testimony not just on this bill, but also on the what the work they're doing around brownfields right now. But I see Representative Frederick in the audience, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing temporarily for House Bill 2241 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2717. And while Representative Frederick's coming up, Beth, could you give us a description of this bill?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2717 would establish a tax credit of $1,000 for a tax credit for a taxpayer who creates 25 or more jobs or increases the number of jobs by 30% over a three-year period during the removal or remedial action of a hazardous waste site. The revenue and impact and fiscal impact statements have not yet been prepared.
Thank you, Beth. Representative, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. House Bill 2717 represents one approach to dealing with a significant problem in all of our districts. The last time I asked for an estimate, there were more than 140 small contaminated sites in my district. And it's an interesting thing I discovered in looking into it is that all districts, all of your districts, have something comparable. As I recall, about it was 4 years ago, Representative Bentz, that we brought a map for you that showed about 150 or so in your district as well. Your district is a little larger than mine, but one portion of your district is a little larger than mine. But frankly, they are closer together. My contaminated sites are closer together because everything is closer together in my district. They are old gas stations or fuel depots with leaking underground storage tanks. They're old machine shops where solvent and fuel disposal took place under mid-20th century practices. They are former dry cleaners, something the statute gives a great deal of special attention to. Photo finishing shops, battery dealers, recyclers, and farm chemical storage. Some of the chemicals stored could not even be used now, much less stored in a way that leaves the residues in the ground. In most cases, the businesses and owners who did the contaminating are long gone. The land is unusable because of toxic substances. Structures on the land fall into disrepair and become eyesores and hazards in their own right. They are usually commercial properties, zoned for commercial use with commercial access and utilities available. However, our property tax system provides some perverse incentives to just let these properties sit. Also, owners wait, hoping for the best economic conditions to make development pencil out after the expense of remediation. Or families that have inherited these properties wait, hoping for a better deal on sale. Now, this is a well of available property, currently not contributing to the economy, and in fact, a drag on the value of surrounding property, as well as the quality of the neighborhood experience in my district. I'm not the only one working on this because it is by no means just a Portland problem, and there are several bills that take different approaches to making it more likely that these properties will be appropriately cleaned up and returned to productive use. So the approach I'm proposing is a tax credit, with the intention that the cost to the Treasury would be offset by taxes paid on wages generated by jobs created during the removal or remedial actions. It's a narrowly focused approach. Others are bringing some grander ideas. It provides a $1,000 against taxes otherwise due if 25 or more jobs are created or the number of jobs is increased by 30% over a three-year period during a removal or remedial action. Here's some statute references for you. 465.500-545 addresses cleanup of dry cleaner facilities. You have the Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act, and there's also a removal or remedial action of hazardous substances. And you can also address some of the civil penalties as well. In 2011, we managed to pass a bill that I'm very proud of, and it set up a system so that the DEQ and others would in fact give they would tell anyone who was cleaning up a brownfield what contaminated that particular brownfield and what was going to be needed to clean it up, and they would not be held liable for anything else found on that brownfield, and they would not be held liable for past things that had taken place. Now, there was a reason for that for me personally. There was a brownfield that was only two blocks from my house that had been sitting empty for 30 years. It had a whole gas station and small grocery store had been there at one time, but it was sitting there empty. The reason that I knew that it was a brownfield was because one day I had my VW bus. I'm very proud of that VW bus. It no longer exists, but it was a VW bus, iridescent green, yellow, with a blue stripe around it. And yes, it was a California Colors bus, and yes, it was a hippie bus, and it was my favorite. But I had it repaired in that particular spot, and I came out to the back to pick up my car, and I got in the car, and the mechanic came out of the back of the shop with a bucket of liquid, and he took it and he poured it onto the ground. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I've got this solvent. It's no longer good. I need to get rid of it." I said, "You can't do that." He said, "I've been doing it for years. What are you talking about?" That's the kind of thing that was taking place. And and many people would not even know where that came from. But the DEQ, and we worked together on this, and we managed to pass a bill that was very effective. Has become to be very effective, I hope, so that people who do that cleanup are not held liable for any future things found there and are able to get something accomplished there. So I was very pleased with that. This is another attempt to say we really want to get these things used. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Benson. Yeah, thank you. So this is a, thank you for bringing the bill again, but this is a nationwide situation imposed almost by CERCLA and other federal laws. Are there other states that have fought their way through this same mess and reached some sort of solution that helps bring business to these areas without all the wreckage that goes with assuming that liability?
The 2011 bill that I mentioned was part of that effort and part of the research that we did on that initially. So, and there are other states that have done different parts of it. Pennsylvania was mentioned, I think, by Representative Davis, but there are other states. Washington has also been doing some things. There are a number of states that are attempting different ways of trying to clean up these spots. Everyone has the Superfund sites all around the nation, but it's these small corner lots where we used to have gas stations every few blocks that are the problem for me in my neighborhood, or the farm implement places that farm supply places. Both of those end up with being small spaces that are contaminated, and everyone's trying to find some way to get those things cleaned up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2717 temporarily and open a work session on House Bill 3257. This is a work session, colleagues, on the Payment Assistance Program funding. You heard this the other week when I was not here. Beth, can you remind us a little bit about this bill, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3257 would extend the sunset on the collection of certain monies from electric companies or the Oregon Community Power for purposes related to low-income electric bill payment assistance from January 2nd, 2016 to January 2nd, 2018. There is a revenue statement on OLIS. There's no fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Right. Chair Vega Peterson, I move House Bill 3257 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 3257 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Excused.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Reardon.
Aye.
Chair Vega Peterson.
Aye. The motion passes. So is there anyone who would like to carry this bill? Have Representative Johnson?
Yeah.
I was going to say, have our freshman carried a bill yet?
I think yeah.
You have?
I have, yeah.
Have you?
For this committee, I don't believe so.
Okay. Why don't we assign it to Representative Helm?
Sure. Thank you.
Here we go. Okay, wonderful. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 3257, and let's reopen the work the public hearing on House Bill 2241. And it looks like for that one we have DEQ to come up. So can we have Palmer Mason? Bruce Giles, come up. Welcome. Please go ahead whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. We are here to speak on House Bill 2241. We are neutral on the bill, and I have with me here Bruce Gillis. He is the program manager for our Environmental Cleanup and Emergency Response Program, and he'll be providing the bulk of the testimony. I did want to recognize that Representative Davis did reach out to us early on this bill, and we've had several conversations, and I think as he explained, his intent is to look more at how we can facilitate cleanup of these properties. They are valuable sites that are being underutilized and undervalued. Representative Frederick spoke to that issue too. So the department is very interested in that conversation, and I just wanted to make that note to the committee of Representative Davis's outreach to us.
Chair Megan Peterson and members of the committee, I am Bruce Gillis, Cleanup Program Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality, Operations Division. I'm here today to offer several observations related to House Bill 2241. As was previously stated, House Bill 2241 requires DEQ to conduct a study and propose recommendations for a single coordinated process for parties to meet certain federal and state requirements for and to obtain releases from liability for cleanup of hazardous waste. It is DEQ's belief that the coordination between DEQ and EPA currently is already in place and functioning very effectively in Oregon. The impetus for this study appears to be a memorandum of agreement entered in 2004 between the state of Pennsylvania and Region 3 of the Environmental Protection Agency. This agreement undoubtedly has been helpful for Pennsylvania in streamlining environmental decisions for facilities subject to federal regulations. PA agreement was included in the package that was provided to you. DEQ believes that such an agreement may not be needed here in Oregon for several reasons. First, DEQ and EPA Region 10 coordination is required for programs that have been delegated to the state, and equally important for federal Superfund sites that is not an EPA delegated program. For delegated programs, we must meet federal requirements and have been highly successful in doing so. Our cleanup statutes is largely patterned over federal regulation, so federal coordination is relatively straightforward. DEQ has operated a voluntary cleanup program now for 25 years, and has operated under a one cleanup program model for at least the last 10 years. This means that we can complete cleanups in Oregon under one set of regulations that meet the requirements of both state and federal statutes, including cleanups of past PCB releases that are that satisfy EPA requirements under the Toxic Substance and Control Act, or TSCA. DEQ's cleanup rules specify that EPA criteria for evaluating risk to human health and the environment that informs the level of cleanup necessary. As a result of our use of those criteria, our cleanup levels are consistent with those required under federal law. This eliminates the potential for second guessing of our cleanup decisions by EPA and others. DEQ has long managed a brownfield program using EPA funding and has collaborated with the Northwest Environmental Business Council and other state and local agencies in trying to increase awareness to brownfields and the benefits of cleaning them up. We have also broadened brownfield cleanups for redevelopment by our prospective purchaser agreement program, which provides state liability relief to new site owners who agree to implement potential public benefits at a site that they're purchasing. It's important to note that the Pennsylvania agreement with EPA does not resolve federal liability. The provisions under CERCLA Section 128B discussed in that agreement apply to all states. DEQ has overseen and improved the cleanup of thousands of sites in Oregon that were subject to both federal and state regulations in the past 25 years. EPA has not intervened in those actions, except where DEQ has requested their assistance. DEQ, as a matter, does not reopen cleanup projects once they've been completed, except in the cases where there's new releases that have been reported to us. This is most often the case where operating gas stations, where you have underground storage tanks. Those reopeners would apply irrespective of having a liability release from the state or not, or the federal government for that matter. Thank you for the opportunity to offer these observations. I'm happy to answer any further questions you may have.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Reardon, then Representative Colby.
I don't have your testimonies online. I was hoping you would get a copy of it so I can review it later. But in general, it just sounds like, you know, everything's working well. Yet we know we have a huge number of brownfields. So is there additional things that could be looked at that could cause brownfields to be recovered and put back into service more quickly if you were in charge of the world?
Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Reardon, we found that the largest impediment to getting sites cleaned up is funding. Having a source of funds is largely the driver in getting these sites cleaned up. Many of the gas stations that are currently sitting vacant are there because parties either didn't have insurance or exhausted those insurance provisions and are not able to clean those up with their own resources. We have used federal funds to assist in cleaning up gas station sites using federal money. One of the requirements that EPA imposes on the state in using federal funds is that we attempt to recover costs that we expend. I would also note that DEQ is also under the obligation to recover our costs, since our cleanup program is largely funded through direct cost recovery from responsible parties.
And if I might add, Representative Reardon, there's a risk to a party that's interested in a site, and I'm talking about parties that didn't actually cause the original release. And that risk is, of course, the strict liability statute. And even if I'm a prospective developer who's interested in the site, I'm going to be very leery or risk adverse to go on that property, even try and figure out the level of contamination and how much it might cost for remediation. Because if I do so, I enter into that world where I might take on legal liability for that property. And so that has a chilling effect on the ability to redevelop those properties. We do have the prospective purchaser program where an innocent purchaser, someone who didn't cause a release, can come to DEQ and work through an agreement that allows them to take ownership of that property. But as Bruce's testimony talked about, they then have to show that there's some substantial public benefit to the redevelopment of that property and enter into an agreement that commits them to doing the assessment of the contamination and the remediation. And if they go through that process, then they won't be held liable for the past releases. And the bill that Representative Frederick talked about in 2011, we worked with the Port of Portland and some other entities to provide protection through that process against third-party lawsuits. So if I was an innocent purchaser, a developer who went through a prospective purchaser agreement and took on the property, I would not only get a release protection from the state, but I wouldn't face liability from some other third party for those releases that were covered under the plan. So we have some tools like that, but again, developers are leery to take that first step if they are going to be at risk or at potential risk for liability and take that first step of trying to assess the contamination and the work that needs to be done.
Just thinking, especially if it's a really small piece of property, the amount of time involved in doing all of this would probably be put a person off right there. Is there any way to prospectively investigate some of the properties so that they were made somehow, somebody would know when they're looking at the information about the property, they would know in advance whether it's developable or not? Or have we ever looked at kind of doing an inventory of brownfields and trying to figure out what it would take to fix them?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, that's an excellent question, and that's probably the unfinished thought. What I was saying is that's where we can have public financing or public dollars come in and help us do that inventory. And if you do that inventory, it can help us assess the risk of contamination, the extent of the contamination, and give some idea of what the cost of cleanup might be for parties. And if the state does that, then there's not the risk of the legal liability for the private party. And that is one thing that is talked about. I don't know that anybody has come up with the magic fund for doing that, but that is something that gets actively discussed.
All of that in my district is pretty good. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holvey.
Thanks. I'm curious if our liability statutes are something that's required by the EPA.
Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Holvey, our liability statute in under state law is similar to the federal requirements. We do have exemptions from liability in cases, certain cases. So inheritance, for example, does not impose liability on the heir of that estate. Is one example of an exemption from liability. They're still left with a contaminated property, however. Also, if a party did due diligence prior to purchasing a property, they are exempt from liability under our statute. That's similar to the federal provision for all appropriate inquiry that EPA has adopted. So if someone hired a contractor, they looked at the history of the site, perhaps did some sampling and didn't identify an actionable problem, and they proceeded to purchase the property and then later found that, oh, we missed something, they wouldn't necessarily be liable for that contamination. We would expect them, though, to undertake certain provisions to make sure that the people that are working there are safe. So that we call those due care provisions to make sure that employees are protected. And that's often less expensive than doing a full cleanup. But otherwise, the federal or the state liability provisions were enacted with our statutes in 1988, I believe, when the first law was passed.
But we're not mandated by feds, are we?
Our regulations I had mentioned earlier were patterned off of federal requirements back in those days.
Would you say that the trend is that we are still identifying brownfield sites? Is it just an unknown number of how many of these sites might exist, or do you feel like we've done a good job of having an inventory of where these sites might be?
Madam Chairman, there has been numerous site discovery efforts over the years. I think we've captured the large majority of sites that we know are contaminated in Oregon. There's over 5,000 non-tank sites. There's been about 10,000 underground oil tanks that have leaked, regulated tanks. We've cleaned up all but about 900 or 1,000 of those in the past 25 years or so. The ones that remain are largely sites that have been contaminated for decades, and they frankly don't have the wherewithal to finish the project. And we've been slowly working through that backlog with federal funding, where we have where we work with our regional solutions teams and try to find opportunities to assist in getting properties back into productive use. So we've spent about close to $750,000 in the last year to 2 years of federal funds to clean up about 9 sites in Oregon using federal resources.
9 sites, you said?
9 sites.
And how much money?
About $650,000 or something thereabouts.
Okay, $650,000 for 9 sites. Okay. And did you provide these? These are great. I think this is really interesting. So we have each of us have a mm-hmm. map of our own districts and show the number of cleanup and lust sites. I don't know what exactly that is. I don't think that the strip club's in my district, though. But they are. But I have almost 50 in my district alone. And a lot of these are on the main boulevards where we would love to have, I think, new businesses going in, places where people are already traveling, already going. But, you know, there's probably over 20 in just along some of the main corridors. So this is obviously an issue for a lot of us in a lot of our different districts. And obviously there's been a lot of work done. Do we have any estimate at the current rate? What's the capacity of the programs based on, you said that there are 10,000 underground oil tanks, and I forget what you said for the other types of contaminants?
Madam Chairman, DEQ is currently working on roughly about 400 sites statewide, mm-hmm. And that's about our capacity. We have about 40 employees that do various types of cleanup work in Oregon. Including federal Superfund sites, and we've got a fair amount of resources devoted to Portland Harbor. We don't have a large backlog of sites coming to us asking for assistance. We have a program rep with each of our regions that helps assist parties that have an interest in resolving their contamination issue they might have with their property. And so in our northwest region and eastern regions, we typically can work on those fairly quickly. In our western region, where we have the bulk of our unresolved leaking underground storage tanks, we do have a backlog of work that has led to some sites sitting on a waiting list for months, 6 months, or as much as 6 months. So in the most part, we are able to work on sites that are asking for our assistance. We're mostly doing that through a voluntary process today rather than compelling parties to into the program and forcing them to do cleanup. We only do that in extenuating circumstances where we've got current exposures that are significant enough that we believe they pose a substantial risk to human health.
And Madam Chair, if I can add to that question and also to the earlier questions from Representative Reardon. Representative Davis mentioned recapitalizing the Brownfields Trust Fund at Business Oregon. So just for the sake of the committee, the governor's budget does recommend putting $7 million in that fund to recapitalize it. As I understand that fund, it can be used for both the assessment side, determining the extent of contamination and type of contamination, as well as the actual remediation of a property. And I think they have a pretty good track record, a successful track record of doing a lot of good work around that, but you should ask Business Oregon for more details. But that is under discussion this year here at the Capitol.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holby.
Thanks. I need to ask a remedial question, I guess, mostly about this map. So the cleanup site that's got the purple star is a site that has been cleaned up, I assume, or a site that needs to be cleaned up?
That's a good question.
I think it includes both.
I believe that it includes both, Representative Holby.
And then the regulated lust site is a site that you want to clean up? that you're lusting to clean up? I don't know.
That could be a situation where we've done a cleanup and had to reopen it for a new leaking tank. So those are not uncommon. I believe these are the open sites that remain, but I'm not certain of that. And we may not be working on most of these sites shown on the maps currently. We just took information from our database for the district boundaries that we have and gave you a snapshot of what sites are in your district without regard of whether we're currently working on them, whether they're waiting to be worked on, or whether they've been completed.
And just for the sake of clarity, it just so happens that the acronym for underground leaking storage tank is LUST.
I was just trying to follow up. I was just trying to figure out what the difference between the purple stars and the gold stars were, one being a regulated LUST site and the other one being a cleanup site.
So, Representative Hall, the LUST sites are the gas station sites that are regulated, and that's a delegated program by EPA. And they're unique from our cleanup sites that can have both petroleum from unregulated tanks, above ground tanks, for example, or have had other historical spills or releases historically at those facilities.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what was the process that went into determining these locations of the sites that we see on these diagrams? How does DEQ know that there are tanks, in fact, or whatever, on these pieces of property?
I can feel it. Representative Johnson, we learn of releases on tank sites, the LUST sites, because they are required to report a release when it's discovered. So part of our spill prevention program for underground storage tanks is they have to monitor their tanks for leaks, and there's a process that they're required to do. And if they detect a loss of fuel that's unaccounted for, they'll assess whether they've had a leak, and if they discover one, they must report it to us. So that's how the tank sites come into the into the program. It's an obligation that's passed on through the federal regulation. With respect to cleanup sites, often those are historical sites where we've had a spill perhaps decades ago, or a property transaction is occurring. Someone does their due diligence, identifies a problem, and now it comes to our attention because it gets reported perhaps to us or not, or we find out about it from a third party. So the non-regulated tank sites are not required to report to us unless there's a new spill that exceeds a reportable quantity. And so often spill sites that can't be cleaned up quickly in our spill program get referred over to the cleanup program for long-term response actions. Those are rare, but that is some of the universe of sites we work on as well. But often they were under some inspection program by our water program or our hazardous waste program and identified certain situations at those facilities where they identified releases related to their manufacturing activities or whatever.
So what then is the net impact or the actual impact to the landowners who have one of these either orange or purple stars on the map? Does it preclude them from using their property for anything in the current time, or does it preclude them from doing some sort of expansion of commercial activity, or what does it do to the folks on the ground that actually own the property that is either a LUST or a cleanup site?
Madam Chairman, Representative Johnson, usually the property continues to be used as it has been, especially, you know, mm-hmm. a gas station will continue to operate unless they have to dig a tank up, and then they'll have to shut it down temporarily while they have a hole in the ground and are removing contaminated soil. Those are typically short-term actions on those types of facilities. On others, often business continues in its current pace. Often situations arise where someone wants to get a loan to expand their operations, and the bank requires them to do certain things to assure that they're not taking on risk or making a bad investment. And so often the bank will require some property assessment before they'll lend on that land. And so that's another mechanism where things come up. And but for the most part, businesses continue to operate, and we try to put in controls. If we have vapors entering buildings, we can mitigate that without tearing a building down. And so we can put fans in, work with HVAC systems to put sites back into safe use, but and then there's an obligation for them to maintain those controls while that's ongoing.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. It looks like we have David Reinhart signed up to testify next. Oh.
Whatever Paul is testifying.
Gotcha. Okay, you just signed up on the wrong sheet.
It's on the opposite panel.
So, is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2241, Rep. Davis's bill? Okay. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2241 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2717. And I think the only person we had signed up to testify on that one is Aaron Weiner. Aaron? Going once? Going twice?
That's not Aaron.
Are you also on the drive org? Okay. So we're going to go ahead and close the hearing at 2717 unless there's anyone else who wants to testify on the tax credit bill. All right. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing that everybody is here to testify at on House Bill 2092. Beth, could you provide the committee with a summary of that bill, mm-hmm. please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2092 would establish a tax credit for contributions to a zero emission incentive fund for the tax years 2016 through 2021. It also directs the Department of Revenue in cooperation with the Department of Energy to conduct an auction of tax credits and sets parameters for that auction. It requires the Energy Director to adopt rules to achieve specified program goals and establishes a $15 million annual cap for tax credit certifications. There is posted on all those both a Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendment.
Okay, thank you very much. Is Representative Frederick planning on coming back for that?
We can call him.
Okay.
I think Rep. Barnhart was there.
Representative Barnhart, you want to come on down? And we're just going to check to see if Representative Frederick also wanted to testify in this bill. Please go ahead whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, and it's good to be back. I have not prepared remarks on this bill, and I have to tell you that I've only just recently reviewed the Dash 3 amendment. I think there are a number of people behind me who will speak to the specifics. I want to speak in very general terms about this bill and ones like it. What we know, there he is. What we know so far is that states that have significant incentives for the purchase of electric vehicles are finding that a significant number of electric vehicles are being sold in those states. Some of those incentives are significantly large. Some of them are smaller. But the rate of electric vehicle adoption is higher in those states. I would refer you especially to the state of Washington, state of California, and one of the southern states, I believe it's Georgia, that has had very significant sales above what Oregon has done lately. I would note a couple of things about this sort of issue. One of them is that simply offering a rebate program increases the likelihood that people who are shopping for a new car will look at an electric vehicle. They're more likely just to take a look and make decisions based on that having looked. Well, my belief is that once you get someone in an electric vehicle, get them to drive it, get them to understand how it works, even a little bit, and they tend to become excited about it. The reality is that only about 30% of Americans even know about the idea of electric vehicles in any significant way, and this would be a way of improving that. The other thing I would note was that several years ago we had a tax credit for electric vehicle adoption, which we allowed to lapse or we repealed, I can't recall which, because then Representative, and it was the impetus really was then Representative Sarah Gelser, now Senator Gelser, reported or talked about the reality that tax credits of this kind of thing tend to be taken by people who are relatively more well off. And of course the reality of that is that only people who are relatively well off actually owe taxes in the amounts that we're talking about. So switching it to a rebate instead of a tax credit makes some sense to consider. The other thing to consider, which I did not consider at the time, is that new car buyers tend to be on the top half of the income distribution. People who are not new car buyers buy used cars, and they buy used cars because they cost less and because they provide basic transportation that people want. I submit the way that you get used electric vehicles is that you sell new ones. After a while, you end up with used ones, and they become available for people who are lower income. So part of then Representative Gelser's argument was perfectly valid. I think another part of it probably is not. And while I don't want to talk about the details of this bill, other people want to do that. I think that this is one of those that ought to be in the mix for future conversation to consider. If one of our objects is to reduce the use of fossil fuels in transportation, one of many things that we need to consider doing is things that have to do with incentivizing people to buy or lease and use electric vehicles.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. I come at this in a very different way. I'm not one of the new early adopters of some things. I do follow those things rather carefully. What concerns me and what I would like to see is I have within my community, a lot of my community, folks who are spending a lot of money on cars that are using a lot of gas. And if there was a way for me to have those folks not be spending $3 or whatever the price is right now, instead it costing them about a dollar for the equivalent use of a vehicle, I'd like to have that take place. I'd like to have some of the poorer folks in my community, some of the folks who are now who could use that money for other things, medical issues, food, rent, be able to actually do that kind of thing, which is because they have access to an electric vehicle that would be effective, especially in the urban community. They're not necessarily having to travel a good distance. They have a number of other access issues in terms of transportation, but this is something that I am trying to push as well, as many folks as possible. I'm also trying to find as many charging stations as possible. I was just here a minute ago talking about brownfields. Well, guess what? Brownfields would be a pretty good place to put a couple of charging stations. And in fact, in my district, that's exactly what has happened. There have been several places that were brownfields that became charging stations. So these are the kinds of things that I'm interested in. I'd like to. I believe it would provide a different transportation system for folks who right now are using gas guzzlers of one form or another that they can't repair because they don't have the money to repair and they don't have the money to purchase them necessarily. Anything that we can do to bring folks there would be helpful. I'm also suggesting a great deal of to get some of the folks who many people in my community look up to begin to try these electric vehicles. And they would then find themselves probably using them as well. So that's the approach that I'm taking. I think we can save a lot of money for a lot of folks, as well as I hope potentially create some jobs there for electric vehicles. As I understand it, in Oregon we presently make about 14 different electric vehicles, and they are not cars necessarily. Although I think we have a few cars, but we have motorcycles and we have. Folks, we have things that move the planes, the jets around at the airport, and there are forklifts as well. I'm not suggesting those forklifts would be going down the street necessarily, but we do have other vehicles, and if we begin to see that kind of use, then I think we begin to bring in other jobs as well and save money and save energy for a lot of the folks in my community.
Thank you so much. Questions for the panel? Representative Reardon.
Do these electric vehicles come in blue and green iridescent colors?
I hope so.
In the shape of a bus?
I certainly hope so.
Okay.
That is what I'm hoping for right now, as a matter of fact. I was going to put a few flowers on the side of them.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I was hoping something like that, yes.
Follow up. What monthly, do you have a monthly price range that folks in your district would want to pay? I'm only paying a little over $200 a month for my lease. And is that something reasonable in your area?
I think that's very possible. We have a number of car clubs in my district, Dodge 300s and Dodge 200 car clubs. I know they're paying at least that for leasing. For their vehicles, so I think there's a possibility of something like that taking place. These vehicles are no longer, some of them are, at a very high price, but a number of them are not, and you don't necessarily need to have a very large vehicle for some of the places that I'm dealing with.
Just closing comment, but I think, you're getting a couple $100, no repairs, and a third of fuel cost, so I would think it'd be really attractive for your mine.
And if we can make them more attractive, even better.
Further questions? Thank you both so much for coming to testify on this bill today. Okay, next we have Jeff Allen from Drive Oregon, who's going to come up and tell us a little bit more about this bill. And I believe we have Robert Westcott, who's going to be on the phone. Okay, so we'll call him in.
Do you want to transfer him up?
Which bill was that again?
92?
Yeah. Hello, is this Robert Westcott?
Three, is it actually?
Yes, it is. Hi, Robert. This is Representative Jessica Vega Peterson. We are have you on in the House Energy and Environment Committee. We have Jeff Allen, who's going to testify on the bill, and then we'd be glad to have your testimony as well.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Representative Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Allen. I'm executive director of Drive Oregon. We're a nonprofit organization here working to grow the electric vehicle industry and promote electric transportation in Oregon. And we're primarily an economic development organization. And frankly, just to give you some context, we've sort of backed into this work to promote more electric cars, more charging infrastructure in the state, because we've realized that one of the key things we need to do to grow this industry in Oregon is to continue to maintain one of the top markets for these vehicles. It's a lot like, you know, the reason that the outdoor apparel industry has thrived here, or solar or wind industries. It really helps to have a vibrant early adopter market right out the back door, where you can that you can use as sort of a living laboratory. And as we looked at how do we continue to maintain Oregon's leadership in electrification, we realized we've done a lot of things right. We've been very creative in using some federal funds to put in charging infrastructure. We've done a lot of work, really creative, low-budget Oregon kind of work to raise the visibility of these vehicles. One of my personal favorites is the electric byways program, where we've now integrated electric vehicles into our tourism promotion efforts. But the one piece that we don't have is a incentive for the purchase of the vehicles. And that's really the most effective way to move more electric vehicles. And we have folks from the auto industry here today to testify who will talk more about that. But while the vehicles are very affordable and very fun to drive and have virtually no maintenance costs, they do still tend to cost a little bit more up front. And that's what people tend to look at is that upfront sticker price. So you can lease them for $150, $200 a month, but there may still be a $3,000 down payment, which can be tough for some folks to come up with. So what we're trying to do here is make these vehicles more affordable for working families, for middle-class families in Oregon, help them make that down payment so they can get into the vehicle that has virtually no maintenance and virtually no fuel costs. So very basic level, what the bill does, it creates this rebate program of up to $3,000 for pure electric vehicles, lower levels for plug-in hybrids and electric motorcycles and so forth. It also provides funding for at least three pilot projects to really look at how do we, in a focused way, get more electric vehicles into those low and moderate income neighborhoods that Representative Frederick was talking about. So these would be pilot projects such as brokering placement of used electric vehicles into community-based organizations or into car-sharing programs in low- and moderate-income neighborhoods. Could also include work to really focus on getting more electric vehicles into some of our rural communities where they make sense. I'm not going to say that, Enterprise, for example, is a great place to have an electric vehicle. But if you look at where they're selling now in the state, the Rogue Valley down in southern Oregon is one of the top per capita markets, and it's a really logical place for electric vehicles. So doing some focused work in regions like that that haven't gotten as much attention but really are a great place for electric vehicles. The bill would also direct the Department of Energy, the Oregon Department of Energy, to contract with independent third parties, both to manage the pilot projects but also to manage the rebate program. That's been a very effective model in Massachusetts and California, where you have a third-party administrator issuing the checks and marketing the program and working with the dealers. And it would provide funding for the rebates. The proposed funding mechanism is an auction of tax credits to capitalize this fund. So I think with that, I won't belabor all my written testimony. We have a lot of other folks who would like to tell you from their perspective why they think this is a good idea. But we wanted to lead off with Dr. Prescott talking a little bit about the economic benefits of electric vehicles to the state of Oregon and some research that they've just released today that quantifies that. So I will pause there.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony. Appreciate it. So I think, and you referenced it, I do think that this program would be more beneficial for those who may live in more developed or urban areas within the state of Oregon. Would you also support, let's just say, an incentive for somebody who lives in Enterprise, who trades in their Dodge pickup for a Prius that goes from getting 10 if the goal here is carbon reduction, lowering our carbon footprint, somebody in Enterprise who trades in their old gas guzzler for a Prius or some other high mileage conventional vehicle, would that not also be something that we should be considering making available so that all of Oregon could share in some of the benefits of a program like this?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I think, first of all, just to be clear, I think how well electric vehicles work for you is more a function of your driving patterns than where you live in the state. So I may have oversimplified. I know there's been a lot of research that says people in rural areas don't drive more miles total than people who live in urban areas, but they drive them differently, right? So I have a lot of friends who live in rural areas. Day-to-day basis, they may not drive that many miles, but they make a lot more long trips, you know, several hundred mile trips. So a full electric vehicle might not work for them, but a plug-in hybrid that goes 40 or 50 miles on electricity and then kicks over into gas could work really well for them. So first of all, just to be clear, there's a lot of places where they work. But second of all, I think if we had the resources, that kind of incentive program would be great. The third, and we used to have, as you may recall, a tax credit for hybrid vehicles here in Oregon. I guess that's my third point, is that, just to be clear, I'm not personally promoting this as a carbon reduction strategy. I'm promoting this as a way to accelerate the growth of this particular technology and industry here. And so we had tax credits for the hybrid vehicles when they were first introduced, partially to kickstart the market for those vehicles and to really get them to a place in the marketplace where they had critical mass. And I think that's what we're trying to do here. You know, it's a lot like green building products or energy efficient appliances or rooftop solar or things like that. So it's more building the industry than on a straight CO2 reduction.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to why don't we have Dr. Westcott give his testimony, and then we'll take questions from both. All right, Dr. Westcott, please go ahead.
Yes, Chairwoman Vega Peterson, Vice Chairman Johnson, Vice Chairman Bearden, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Robert Westcott, and I'm president of Keybridge Research, LLC, an economic consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. Keybridge provides economic analysis to Fortune 500 companies, global financial institutions, nonprofits, business associations, and U.S. Federal government agencies. I'd like to thank you for inviting me to testify today. I wish I could be there in person, but I sort of am because I've been watching you online, so that's good. I'm a PhD economist, and I have 35 years of experience working on macroeconomic, energy, and public policy issues. Before founding Keybridge, I was chief economist at the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and I was also a special assistant to the President for Economic Policy at the White House. Today, I'd like to report on a new economic modeling study that we're just releasing. The title of it is Impact of Introducing an Electric Vehicle Rebate on the Oregon State Economy. As Jeff just said, this study was commissioned by Securing America's Future Energy, a partnership with the Electrification Coalition, and it was prepared by our firm. I've submitted written testimony that I understand has been logged in your state document system. To evaluate the impact of an EV rebate, our study evaluates two scenarios, a baseline scenario in which Oregon continues to have no EV rebate, and a policy scenario that assumes that an EV rebate goes into effect starting in 2015 and lasts for 5 years. The study quantifies the impact of a rebate on the Georgia state economy by comparing the two scenarios. So our work covers the period 2015 to 2030. The study relies on a micro-level consumer model based on data from the Electric Power Research Institute. They had two studies in the past 2 years that provide a very detailed picture of the economics of EV ownership. And we also rely on a macroeconomic model of the state of Oregon. This is a 70-sector model of the state of Oregon produced by REMI, the leading producer of regional economic models. But let me share the key results with you of our study. We find that a tiered EV rebate, so $3,000 for battery electric vehicles and $1,500 for plug-in hybrids, would boost Oregon's real GDP each year between 2015 and 2030. The cumulative 5-year gain in Oregon's GDP would be $38 million, and the cumulative 16-year gain would be $83 million. Now, just again, state GDP is equal to aggregate income of all people in the state of Oregon. The overall gain in Oregon's GDP occurs despite an assumed reduction of state government spending by the same amount as the aggregate EV rebates in order to keep the state's budget position unchanged. That's very important in this study. Further, the study finds that with the rebate, Oregon drivers would save $46 million in gasoline bills over the next 5 years, and $212 million through 2030. These savings are only partially offset by a cumulative increase of $59 million in higher electricity bills. So that is the fuel savings. With fuel savings, Oregon consumers can take some of that money and then could spend it on other goods and services in the state. We assume a gasoline price of $2.62 a gallon in 2015, and this increases gradually over time in line with the latest Department of Energy forecast. We did look at what would happen if gasoline prices were substantially lower or substantially higher, $1 a gallon lower, $1 a gallon higher, and they do not materially change the outcome. The state GDP would be higher in all cases under all plausible gasoline scenarios with an EV credit. The two key reasons why state GDP would increase in Oregon. First, with more EVs on the road, in the case of the EV rebate, Oregon drivers would pay less for transportation fuel because electric vehicles are significantly cheaper to operate over their lifetime than conventional vehicles. They would basically boost their spending on other Oregon-produced goods and services, especially electricity. And they would cut their spending on gasoline, which is heavily imported into the state of Oregon, which is a subtraction from Oregon GDP. The second key channel that we see is that the rebate would incentivize more Oregon purchasers to buy EVs, and therefore there'd be more inflows of that $7,500 federal tax credit into Oregon. That actually ends up being a substantial inflow and is a direct addition to Oregon household income. So let me just finally just conclude by just giving one quick statement of how this study might be used. Economists like to perform cost-benefit analysis when they look at a proposed policy in order to determine whether that policy would yield a net benefit or a net cost to the state. This modeling exercise we've just done, this basically essentially is an elaborate cost-benefit analysis. The results indicate that with an EV program, it would yield positive benefits to the state of Oregon in the form of a boosted GDP. So that basically does say that this would be a positive thing for the state of Oregon, even if it was fully paid for by the at a real-time basis. So, Madam Chairwoman, let me stop there and take questions if you have any.
Okay, thank you so much. Representative Holley.
Thanks. I'm curious, as I'm looking at this rebate program, if there was consideration of narrowing the rebate more heavily to a lower income demographic that would produce perhaps more sales of EV cars, since my observations is many of the more wealthier individuals buy them without the rebate.
Yeah, we did not look at a focused program that would target one particular income category or another. I would say we've done a lot of examination of EV policies in different states, and if you look at a state like Georgia, for example, the evidence suggests that a lot of those vehicles are being purchased by middle-income households. The $199 lease deals are quite attractive. A lot of middle-income folks involved.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, if I could speak to that as well. We've looked at the numbers in Oregon, and 90% of the electric vehicles registered here have a base MSRP of $35,000 or less, which is about average MSRP in Oregon. So the Tesla is a great car. It gets a lot of publicity because of that, but it's a very small percentage of the vehicles that are actually being sold.
Follow up.
I guess what I was driving at, it seems like a program would be more effective if it focused at that price range instead of the Tesla price range.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, we have talked about that a fair bit, and we're very open to continuing to talk about that. There's some challenges. One is we want to keep it very simple and clear. We are certain that auto dealers don't want to ask people to bring in their tax forms when they're looking at cars, and people are very reluctant to share that information. And we also know that the dealers are very reluctant to promote any kind of an incentive that they're not absolutely certain they can deliver to people. And I think we have some auto industry folks who can speak to that more. So if it becomes, this has been a problem with tax credits in some other states, where if the dealer has to say, well, you may or may not get the full credit, it depends on your tax situation, consult your tax attorney, then what happens is they just don't tell people about the credit at all. And that was a problem in Oregon when we used to have an incentive for the hybrid vehicles several years back. We found that many dealers didn't tell people about that incentive, and many people didn't take advantage of it for some of those reasons. So it's a good point, one we're open to continuing to explore, but it's tricky to figure out how to balance that.
Representative, I just have a follow-up question to that. So I just want to jump in real. Aren't there, like, we're all doing our taxes right now, aren't there, like, tax preparation software that actually helps in, like, get some of those questions to really try to get some of that information out of taxpayers when they're doing that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, yes. And one of the other issues here, as Representative Barnhart raised, is we're trying to do this as a point-of-purchase rebate rather than as a tax credit for a couple of reasons. One is people with moderate income don't always have enough tax liability to take advantage. One is that if you make it a point-of-purchase rebate, then the dealers and the auto companies can roll it into the financing of the vehicle in a way they can't with a tax credit. So if it's a $199 a month lease but a $3,000 down payment, if it's a rebate at the point of purchase, they can use that rebate to pay the down payment. If it's a tax credit, they can't do that. So if it were a tax credit, it would be a lot easier to means test it. Absolutely.
Okay. Excuse me for interrupting. Go ahead, Representative Reardon.
Dr. Westcott, this is Representative Reardon. I'm not an economist, and so when I try to compare, you know, tax credits that the state is giving, and then we see the return on that expressed in growth in GDP, I get a little bit confused. Can you help us understand the real cost to the state for supporting this program and how we might recover that cost?
Yes. So this study, and I feel very strongly about this, this study looks at the state budget as something that needs to be held the same with or without the rebate. So we basically look at what we see about 140% increase in EV sales with the if the rebate were to pass. So that's more people applying for the rebate, and so we look at what the dollar amount of that would be. We then do a reduction in our modeling of other state spending, assuming there has to be a one-for-one offset. And so that's a tough test for any new policy, because it means you have to do better than average. And our study shows that the EV rebate does do better than average. So it more than fills up the tank of the state budget, if you will.
Hello?
I'm not sure I'm following. I have not read the whole paper here. We just got it a few minutes ago. Where is the reduction in state spending? Where does that occur?
Well, what we do, if you look in the appendix tables, you'll see that there's a reduction in the and I don't know if you have the full study there. That's
a
question.
I think so.
But you'll see that there's a if you look in, like, page A1 of the main study, you'll see government spending falls by $11 million a year, basically. And so that's, if $11 million goes into EV rebates, $11 million reduction of state spending, that's the first round effect. So what happens is, because we make the overall economy stronger, the net cost to the state is actually lower than that, because we do have what are called multiplier effects. If we make state GDP higher, we make income levels higher, people pay more state taxes, more sales taxes, everything that they would pay. So that then contributes to a stronger state budget. There's more economic activity in the state.
Okay, thank you.
And I actually had a follow-up to that. Did the study consider the impact to the state's revenue because of the less amount of gasoline that would be used because of these cars?
Madam Chairman, yes. The
the model basically looks at what would happen if we had 140% increase in EV purchases. So basically, we'd be taking EV purchases in the state of Oregon from something on the order of 1,800, 1,840 sales, I think, up to something like 4,400, 4,500 EV sales. And so we basically say, okay, if that number of sales took place each year for the next 5 years, what would be the reduction of gasoline purchases that residents in the state would be making? What would be the increase of electricity sales that people would be making? And we go, actually, there are about 15 different components of consumption that we adjust. We assume they have to pay more as the fixed cost of the vehicle, the capital cost of the vehicle is higher. We assume there'd be some saving in maintenance based on the EPRI study, the Electric Power Research Institute study. We assume that owners of battery electric vehicles would have to rent cars a few days a year because if they want to take a longer trip, that cost is fully reflected in the study and so on. So these are all adjustments that we make to the consumer's pocketbook for the 4,400 folks who would be buying EVs each year over the next 5 years. And so we then aggregate up to what those effects would be on the overall state of Oregon. And then we run it through the REMI macroeconomic model where we get the simultaneous effects on the overall state economy.
Thank you. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff, is that right?
Yes.
I have a Volt. I love my Volt. I'm very interested in the EV market and its future development. I'm excited about the new Tesla and the new Chevy product coming in the next couple years with the extended range and the better pricing and whatnot. It's a little different direction, my question, than what we're talking about as far as rebates at purchase. My question for you is, and I'm hoping you have an answer for me because I really am looking for one, is, I've always wondered, okay, why does Tesla want to make its cars in Nevada? Why does BMW want to make its carbon fiber in Washington for its i3, send it all the way back to Germany, assemble it there, and then ship it back to the U.S. for sale? What is Oregon doing wrong when it comes to courting new manufacturers of the electric cars, which would bring in foreign investment, continuous jobs, ultimately it would help probably lower the cost of Oregon purchases of these cars because it's homegrown right here. How do we get these people to come here and actually start making these factories here?
Madam Chair, Representative Hurd, that's a great question, and I better have an answer because that's what y'all are paying me for through the Oregon Innovation Council. I think the short version is, and our job is to try and attract more of that investment here, is frankly, and we'll have some folks from BMW and other automakers here today and on Tuesday, and you can talk to them directly. I think we got a number of disadvantages when it comes to actually assembling cars here. But I think what we need to focus on are the pieces of the supply chain where we have some advantages. Mm-hmm. Representative Frederick mentioned we have a bunch of folks who make transportation equipment. Daimler Trucks is represented on our board. We have Lectro, which makes aircraft tugs. We have NACO Hyster, Yale, which is one of the premier forklift manufacturers in the country that does its design work here in Fairview. So there's a lot of electric equipment and electric transportation equipment makers. They're just not cars. They're either large things or they're small things like motorcycles, Brammo motorcycles down Southern California or Southern Oregon. Then we have software, which is a huge opportunity. There's more lines of code in your Volt than there is in a 787 Dreamliner. And one of my favorite success stories there is Jaguar Land Rover. It's one of our active members. They have their software design center in the Pearl in Portland. Why are they in Portland? Well, because they're based on an open source software platform. They wanted to go someplace where they could get a lot of good open source software programmers more cheaply than in the Bay Area. So that's an area where we can do a lot more to attract. Most of the major auto companies now have software centers in the Bay Area. So part of what we're trying to do is convince them to bring those up here. Mm-hmm. I think there's some opportunities there. And then some of the other electronic components, power controls, motor controls, motors. It's not as sexy as having a whole automotive assembly plant, but some of the guts of the vehicles are things that we know quite a bit about here. So I think there are a lot of opportunities for us here in Oregon.
Follow up.
Follow up.
So you spoke of disadvantages. I'm curious to have you answer what those disadvantages are. But you talked about making parts and this and that. When I was doing my research on why BMW went to, I think it's Moses Lake, Washington, right? It was because the carbon fiber requires a lot of electricity to manufacture that product, and their electricity prices are a fifth of what they are in Germany, the article claimed. I would assume we're in the same ballpark as far as our cost of electricity. So why did they go to Washington rather than Oregon? And the same goes for Tesla. Why would they go to Nevada versus Oregon?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hurd, I was not involved in the BMW decision, although, like I say, they're a member of ours, and they'll be here on Tuesday, so we can ask them that. My sense is it's a combination of low-cost electricity, but also they have some major land and water needs that they were more able to accommodate up there. I know with Tesla that we did look at trying to bring them here. That is an enormous facility that needed, again, a lot of power, a lot of land, a lot of water, and frankly, a lot of cash from the state. And
in what form? Sorry, follow up.
But you have a lot of people who are set to testify. I like this. It's just not it's not directly pertinent to the bill that's before us today. So I'd like to wrap this up with questioning.
So maybe we can talk more offline, because I'd be happy to do that. I would say when I'm out trying to recruit companies here and so forth, we do not compete well when it comes to handing out large cash incentives to recruit companies. We have other advantages and strengths, like we're a much more attractive place for most people to want to live than Nevada, frankly. We have good, talented workforce. We have some other advantages like that. But when it's a really capital-intensive project like that that needs a lot of land and a lot of incentives, but we can talk more. But it does come back to part of why, as I say, we're pushing for this incentive policy, the rebate policy, is part of what we have going for us is Oregon is as a living laboratory, as a great early adopter market, where if you're making a new electric vehicle or you have a new business model and you want to try it out and see how people are actually going to respond to it, it's much easier to do that in Oregon than it is to do it in California. And if you have a good market and good charging infrastructure and a good installed base of vehicles, that's much more attractive. And increasingly, we are competing for that role with places like Georgia and Indiana and Washington State. So we need to kind of up our game.
Thank you.
Could I make one final question? It'll take a yes or no answer.
Sure.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm just trying to put it all away. And you're basically telling me, from what I'm hearing, we have land, we have water, we have beautiful scenery, we have a lot of the great stuff that they want, but we as a state are just simply not competing on the, say it's suspending income taxes for that factory to come here, or property taxes, what have you. We're not giving them the financial incentives that other states have been willing to actually draw them in here and make us competitive with everybody else, thus complete the whole package to get them here. Is that right?
This is a yes or no answer.
I guess I have to go with mostly yes. Yes, that's a major factor.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
No, I'll pass.
Representative Polvey.
I'll pass, too.
Really? I'm okay.
Does that mean I get more time?
No. But I do. I actually do have a couple questions. So I'm going to ask some policy questions about the bill, because it's a really, I really appreciate the attempt to really focus this more on statewide access for electric vehicles, and also looking at the income levels that are going to be or who this would be available for and who would be able to take advantage of this. So, there are certain issues like that upfront cost of, you know, low monthly payments. That great, but this tries to address that. You know, big down payment that people have to pay when they're leasing a car. What about the infrastructure that's needed in order to have an electric vehicle? We had a hearing just the other day on how expensive it is to, you know, get a quick charging station or the those kinds of roadblocks that are available for folks. So can you address that issue, please?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And I think since the beginning of this round of electric vehicles, people have talked about the chicken and egg argument of, you know, do you need more vehicles? Do you need more chargers for people to buy the vehicles? And I am sort of firmly in the chicken camp, I guess I would say, that People don't worry too much about how they're going to charge the car until they've heard that there is such a thing as an electric vehicle, and they've taken one for a test drive, and then they start thinking about buying one, and then they start to wonder, but where am I going to charge this? And particularly in Oregon, as I said in my testimony, we've done a really good job on the infrastructure. We have more fast chargers per capita than anywhere. And in fact, almost in absolute terms, we have about 80 of these fast chargers in Oregon that'll charge your car in 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Last I checked, the entire state of California only had about 150 or 200 of them. Mm-hmm. So we have a really dense network there, and we have more regular level 2 public chargers per capita than anywhere else. So we've kind of overachieved on that side of the equation. And it's the car side where I think we really need to push more now. And getting more cars on the road is also what makes the charging system work better, because you need a critical mass of vehicles in order for those charging stations to generate enough revenue to pay for themselves. Rule of thumb on a fast charger is you need at least 5 charges, ideally 10 charges a day, for that to start to pay for itself. And we're starting to get there on some of the chargers. The one in Hood River, for example, the most popular charger in the state, across from Full Sail, probably meets that number, but a lot of them don't. So that's why we're pushing on the car side.
Okay. All right. And then, so in here, it looks like with the statutory amendment, you've taken out some of the $15 million ask and just left it blank, as well as some of the blanks in terms of the different amounts of money for the different things. What is an estimate that you're giving in terms of the administration for this program versus the money that would be available for the credits?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, Madam Chair. Part of the reason we want to outsource the, maybe that's the wrong word, but sort of have a third-party independent nonprofit manage the issuance of the credits is that's been pretty cost-effective in places like Massachusetts and California. Rough ballpark is marketing and management of that program is in the 10-15% of program rebate expenditures range. We have taken the dollar figures out at this point because we thought it was best to focus on the policy and make sure we reach some agreement about this being a good policy for the state. And then we're fully aware that this will have to go to the Revenue Committee and compete with a lot of other good policy ideas for funding. And we'll have to see, you know, how much of what we'd like to do we can afford to do.
Okay. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you so much. And thank you, Dr. Westcott, so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. Next, I have Kurt Augustine and Ross Good. And why don't we bring up Joe Esmond as well, who's next.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kurt Augustine, and I'm the Director of Policy and Government Affairs for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, which is a trade association representing 12 of the major manufacturers, both foreign and domestic, and represents about 80% of the market share that of cars sold in the United States. And many of the comments that have been made by the representatives and by Jeff are very similar to what I was going to say, so I will not repeat those for you. And I'll kind of change my remarks and really kind of say why this is important. And there's several reasons from the automaker perspective, because we believe this is a bargain between the automakers, the state of Oregon, and its consumers. First off, the auto industry has come a long way in the last several years. We have a national standard on mileage and greenhouse gas improvements. We have cleaner, safer, higher miles per gallon vehicles. And the specifically on the vehicles that we're talking about, the zero-emission vehicles or ZEV vehicles, there are 20 full production ZEVs available in the United States, and there'll be 2 hydrogen fuel cell cars for sale later this year. Well, what's facing us in the future is by 2025, with the national deal that we made with President Obama, was that we will have a mileage per gallon standards of 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. That's only 9 model years away. That's not very long in the auto industry. In addition, with 10 states, and Oregon is one of those, we have the ZEV mandate, which will require that 15% of all cars offered for sale in the state of Oregon must be a zero-emission vehicle car. And I'll expand on that in a little bit. But first off, I think it's important to build on a remark that Jeff made about the commitment that Oregon has made. It does have one of the better infrastructure recharging systems in the country, both from the public and private sector contributions, and we thank for that, and we believe it's been instrumental in helping sell electric vehicles. What are really the most effective ways to sell electric vehicles that we have seen are two additional items besides having the proper fueling structure. One is rebates. And secondly, our HOV stickers, which is not part of this bill, but allowing single occupancy drivers the ability to go into high occupancy lane vehicles is a primary motivator. What do we have as challenges? It's the ZEV sales mandate. And I start off my remarks as being this is really a bargain between the state and the makers of cars. The state has mandated that they must produce these type of vehicles. That's going to be a challenge. We are committed to do it. It's the law, and we shall, but it is going to be a challenge. Let me explain why. We have the last sales figures of 2014 here in Oregon, it was 1.33% of the vehicles sold in the state were ZEVs. We have to get in 2019 to 6.2%, and in 2025, 19.2%. That's a quantum leap, and it's something that I think is important to understand, especially when we look at the gas prices, which lower gas prices are a disincentive for people to look at electric vehicles. The increased miles per gallon standards of vehicles are now going to get 40, 50 miles per gallon. That makes them makes ZEV vehicles less economically incentivized. Also, many of the program assumptions to get to that 19% of ZEVs were based on $5 to $6 gallons of gasoline. Who knows what the price is going to be over the next few years, but those assumptions were built in now, and so again, has a huge impact on it. But here are the realities. We don't get to 54 miles per gallon without zero emission vehicles. Please don't mistake my comments that we have concerns as they mean that we aren't committed to that, because even with all the technological advantages that we have on traditionally powered vehicles, we're not going to get a fleet average of 54 miles a gallon without zero-emission vehicles. We need to have them. But ZEV sales are hard and expensive. Let me give you an example of the Toyota Prius. It is just a traditional hybrid vehicle. It does not have any of the range anxieties, charging concerns that the ZEV vehicles have. That car's been on the market for 14 years. Its market acceptance rate is 6%. Again, in 9 years, we will have to go to 15% or 19%, depending on how you count it, on zero-emission vehicles who have all those range anxieties. So that's a real-world example of how this is going to be challenging. What we know quite clearly is zero-emission vehicles don't get sold in states without incentives. It's just that. It's that simple. I've handed out some of data for you. You can see in the last pages that it's quite clear, and the mention has been about Georgia. There is no mystery as why Georgia, probably not the first state anybody thinks of as an economic or environmentally friendly state, has the highest percentage of zero-emission vehicles sold in the United States. It's because they have a rebate, and they have HOV sticker access in Atlanta. It's quite clear. So what does increase ZEV sales? It's incentives, and that's why we strongly support this bill. It's the infrastructure that you've already mentioned. It's an education about with our dealers and consumers about the values of these cars. And finally, it's a partnership. It has been our view that if we are required to make these vehicles, that the states that do require us to make those need to be in a partnership to help us sell those vehicles. And that is why we, again, are asking for your support on this bill to help incentivize sales so we can get cleaner vehicles into the hands of folks who want them but who do need those assists. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Just go ahead.
Thank you. Chairwoman Peterson and the members of the board. I'm Ross Good. I'm with Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, or FCA. Probably know us better through our brands, which are Fiat, Chrysler, Dodge, Ram, Jeep, and Mopar. That's how you probably know us. Recently, Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, FCA, introduced the 500E into the Oregon market. It's been been a few months now. We admittedly were a little late to the party, so the idea was if we're going to be a little bit late, we better bring the best wine. And we think we did that with the 500E. It has a lot of best-in-class advantages that we're really quite proud of, and we've seen pretty good acceptance of it here in Oregon. The thing that makes the Fiat 500E so successful is, or as successful as it is in Oregon, is the pretty modest price point. After federal rebates, which are considerable, a federal tax rebate of about $7,500, and other incentives offered, at least in California, we've been able to get the price down to what would be the equivalent of a Fiat 500 with an internal combustion engine. So we've been sort of tried to bite the bullet here to make these vehicles as attractive as we can, so we could, as Kurt mentioned, you know, meet some of these very difficult goals. You know, our goal with the 500E is to get as many electric miles in the places where they're sold as we possibly can. So the best way to do that is get the cars out there, and the best way to do that is to offer attractive leases. What we found with our experience in California is that people are using the rebates either to support a purchase of a level 2 charger or to lower their monthly payment. I think what's really interesting about HB 2092 is that it's at the point of sale, which we could really offer people who weren't considering a new car, offer them the opportunity to use this rebate as their down payment. There's a really attractive lease rate. If you go out on the web right now and look up Tonkin Fiat, they're offering a $98 a month lease with $3,300 down. Well, so for $300 of your own money, you could go in and lease a car for $100 a month. That opens it up to a whole new market, a whole new group of people who previously probably would not have considered a brand new automobile, as we talked about, as you heard testimony on earlier. So we're really quite proud of that. The point of the rebates is really to support the technology so that we can get to the point where these vehicles are commercially viable. That is, where people want to go into the dealership, purchase the vehicle at a price point that is at least break even for the automobile manufacturers. Now, we have nothing against making a little money, but before we get to that point, we have to find the break-even point. So the point of these rebates is really to help lower the price to the point where we can get some understanding of the technology, where we can improve the technology, where we can get some economies of scale built into the system, so that we can get to the point where people want to buy these cars and are willing to pay at least what they cost. When we get to that point, there will be absolutely no need for rebates. There will be no need for incentives, anything like that, but really we're quite a long way from that right now. So I'm glad to answer any questions or give you any more of our experience with the 500E. But as Kurt said, and as I must mention, Chrysler is FCA is a member of both the Alliance and Drive Oregon, so there's no need for me to repeat what they said, but we're really thinking this could be a great benefit for the citizens of Oregon so that we can get as many electric miles on the road as possible. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's go ahead, Joe.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Esmond. I represent the IBW number 48 from Portland, Oregon. I'm on the board of Drive Oregon, and I am 100% in favor of this bill. As we spoke the other day, we have 10 charging stations at our facility, 9 level 2s, and a fast charger. Nationally, our organization has partnered up with our contractors to train our electricians for this new technology, and surprise, surprise, it is based in Detroit. So on the infrastructure side, this is a jobs bill again. My favorite four-letter word, jobs. And I don't know how many we've put in across the state, but we've put in a lot of them. And basically, that's what we do for a living, the electrical industry, and we support this bill.
Thank you so much. Questions for this panel? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the CAFE standards, it's an average, of course, as you guys well know, and the federal program has a credits built into it for manufacturers, as you also well know. And so and there's credits on both sides, both for the manufacturers and for the buyers at the federal level, as we all know. So the question for us here in Oregon is why we would stack Oregon being a small state, why we would go ahead and bring this money to the table given all the other choices. One has to ask, what are we really trying to get done here? And more to the point, would this actually get us there? The real interesting study would be, would the amount of cars sold in this state by virtue of this tax credit in any way advance the overall excitement people enjoy when they go to buy these cars? And I have not seen that here. What I've seen is a lot of other stuff, but none of that. Mm-hmm. So the real issue is, does this advance anything when it comes to the broader explosion of electric cars across the state? I would say, having listened day before yesterday, whenever we listened, the much more exciting thing would be having places to plug these things in as opposed to what we're focusing on here. But I'd love to hear your response to that, but I know we're down very short of time, so I know the chair is going to say, like, 1 minute, or maybe just one word.
I'll trade 1 minute for one word, if I may, Madam Chair. I think the fundamental issue is that with the zero-emission vehicle mandate, which Oregon is only one of 10 states, that is a mandate to produce vehicles. It is not to sell them, but to produce them, whether they can be sold or not. Currently, auto manufacturers are losing approximately $12,000 to $15,000 on every zero-emission vehicle sold. This is a commitment on top of all the costs that it makes to develop these vehicles. So by having this law in Oregon, we believe that it demonstrates a commitment that if we have to make them, and I believe it is probably the only law in the United States that requires a company to make a product, whether it can be sold or not, is the type of commitment that if you're going to require the companies to make vehicles, then that there must be a partnership that we can count on to help sell these vehicles. And we do believe that the incentives have a tremendous amount of motivation for folks. You can look at the sales figures in other states where the incentives don't exist. Market rate is 0.25. In other states, it's up where they have incentives, closer to 2%. Once these vehicles are out there, you know, they do create some market excitement and people understand them that, hey, oh, I can really drive more than down the street. I mean, these things really work. And it does also spur the technology. So we're a strong believer that incentives help move the vehicles, get them out onto the street. And again, back to my line, it is a partnership. If we're required to make them, we do believe it's fair that the government entity that is requiring the companies to make these help us try to sell them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Can I just say,
yeah,
follow up
on the respond?
I just want to make sure that Madam Chair, Representative Bentz knows that it's not as onerous as the good representative Gene made it out to be, perhaps, to install a charging station. No offense to the representative, but he's not in the electrical business, so.
I'm sure. I thought he was getting it from his neighbors through his neighbor's window. I agree with you.
But I am very heartened to hear that the good representative Johnson's district is the number one for three-phase charging.
It's a shame he's not here to hear this.
I know.
But he's working on another bill.
Anyway.
Thank you all so much. I don't see any other questions. So thank you very much for
your
testimony. We really appreciate you being here. All right, next we're going to call up John Morris, Werner Seaman, and David Reinhard. And Aaron Wines, did you want to testify on this bill as well? Okay. Welcome. Please pick who goes first.
I'm Dave Reinhard, representing General Motors. I've already submitted written testimony, and Kurt and Ross couldn't have said it better. And we just want to echo our support for this bill.
Thank you so much.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric on a bill about electric vehicles. It makes some sense to have one of the electric companies testify, we think. We're here testifying in favor of HB 2092. To be fair, and you know, to disclose at the front end, you know, electric vehicles do use electricity, and so we have clearly an interest in promoting the technology. With that disclosure, which has shocked and offended the chair, there are some points that we think are valid to enter in. I won't talk about tax policy or economics necessarily, but from the electrical perspective. First is that for electricity, there's significantly less fuel price volatility over time for electricity than there is with fossil fuels or with oil. We see, because we have regulated prices for electricity, the equivalent is fuel price for electric vehicles is functionally about $1 a gallon and a fairly stable rate over time. There's, I think, often in these conversations, questions come up about whether or not the grid can support EVs, additional deployment of EVs at the level of penetration that we have in the state of Oregon and where we would foresee going in the next several years. I think the answer from our transmission folks is yes, we can support the deployment of additional electric vehicles. We do have the capacity to do so. And as a practical matter, electric vehicles on the grid function effectively as a storage mechanism. I mean, these are cars that have batteries on them, which is a storage device. And generally speaking, people charge their electric vehicles at night. And so as we look at the shape of the load curve, we have charging at night, which serves to optimize the resources that we have on the grid. Lots of renewables, including the Columbia Gorge wind fleet, are often a nighttime generating resource. We get into the springtime, we often have a high hydro, high wind scenario. And sometimes in the last, in 2011-12, we had a problem with some overgeneration. We think that electric vehicles can be a component in terms of leveling out and actually an improvement to the way that we use electricity here in the region. As well, from a fuel source and from a carbon standpoint, this is one of the few with electric vehicles, and given that the energy mix in the state of Oregon is declining in terms of the emissions over time on a per capita basis as we ramp up our RPS standard and retire Boardman, do some of the other changes that we have in the energy mix, an EV is one of the few vehicles that you can purchase that's going to actually get cleaner over time as we shift our energy mix. As we go forward, one of the things that we're concerned about as a utility are pending ozone rules. There was a presentation a couple weeks ago from DEQ. We have some concerns about the level of emissions in urban areas for ozone going forward and new federal rules that are going to be coming down the line. And we think that EVs can play a role in terms of improving the air quality, which has an overall net economic benefit, because if we are able to lower the emissions that we have from the existing or from the vehicle fleet, that creates a little bit more headroom for other things that could have emissions that are economic activity. Second to last thing, our customers do have an interest in electric vehicles. We are seeing a pretty good uptick in our service territory. We have customers that are interested in this. As a utility, we're shifting our fleet increasingly over to electric vehicles, doing some work and looking at having bucket trucks being replacing diesel with electricity, so that when you've got a bucket truck out doing work in a neighborhood, you're working off of a battery rather than having a diesel engine running, which has some noise and some emissions associated with it. PG&E down in California has been working with us on advancing some of that technology. And then the last point I'll make to Representative Hurd's question earlier, power prices in Germany are about four times higher than they are in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair Peterson, members of the committee, my name is John Morris. I'm Director of Policy and Regulatory Affairs for Clear Result. We're an energy efficiency consulting firm. Primarily, our clients are utilities. In Oregon, we serve BPA, NEA, Energy Trust. I'll say this, our written testimony and testimony I'm providing today is completely independent of our Oregon utility clients. But I will say that most of my comments have already been covered. I think it's relevant to share our experience in market transformation work, primarily with the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. And if you think about the work that we've done to move folks from incandescent lighting to CFLs, from strip heat or curtain warmers, as we call them, to ductless heat pumps, and now from typical hot water tanks to heat pump water heaters. The key to all of those transformational technologies is incentives, and they have allowed us to get a larger market adoption of these technologies over time. And I've heard the committee express concern about the incentives will be going to people who might not necessarily need them. And those are typically, for us in our experience in utility programs, those are the early adopters, right? But you need to take a look at a 10-year range and how over time all of the folks that are going to take this technology will span varieties of income ranges. So I think it's okay to accept that there might be higher income initially, but over time, as the market evolves, as the manufacturers see the demand, those price points will come down. That's exactly the trajectory we've seen when we tried to get people to move away from incandescent lighting to CFLs, and again, from what I thought would be almost impossible, which was the ductless heat pump and putting a heating system on someone's ceiling, basically. But we've done that. And we did it with incentives from the utilities, and I think a state-level incentive will do very well to transform the market of electric vehicles.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you all so much. Thank you very much for your testimony. Do you want to, why don't we have we have Odo in here, and I think they're going to be charged with administrating this program. So why don't we have from brief comments from them, because I get gold stars for letting my committee out on time.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning and Innovation at the Oregon Department of Energy. As you heard from the manufacturers, Oregon does have a requirement for sales of electric vehicles that was adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission in 2006. And it does require an increasing percentage of sales of electric vehicles. I will note that that program does also have a built-in reevaluation. So if those numbers can't be achieved, they would be reconsidered prior to the percentages increasing. But nevertheless, we are interested in increasing the number of electric vehicles in the state. And we have heard consistently from the manufacturers what you heard today, that point-of-sale rebates are probably among the most effective mechanisms for encouraging sales of electric vehicles. As a result of that, the state of Oregon entered into an agreement with the other ZEV states in 2013 to collaborate on and work together on things like having common signage, common charging protocols, outreach and incentive programs to help the manufacturers meet their sales targets. So the type of program that's included in House Bill 2092 is the type of program was contemplated in that interstate agreement. However, as introduced, House Bill 2092 does present the department with a number of implementation challenges. We've worked pretty closely with Drive Oregon to point those out, and many of those concerns were addressed in the -3 amendments, but not all of them. So we're happy to continue working with Drive Oregon to address some of the remaining challenges in the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Vince.
So it'd be great to get a copy of that so-called requirement. I'd also sure like and appreciate any kind of legal foundation for its enforcement, and because it seemed to me it was being given far more weight than it deserves when it comes to what the law is in this state. So I would like to see the foundation for the rule, whatever it is, that suggests that could in any way be enforced. So I want to see it. So if it exists, yay, we need to know about it.
The EQC rule.
Whatever it is, yes. Yeah. Yes, Madam
okay.
Chair.
Right. All right.
Okay.
I'm sure they'll get that to us. Thank you very much
for
your testimony. If there isn't anyone else here who wants to testify on this bill, no. Thank you very much, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2092 and go ahead and close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you.